It is impossible for those men to remain loyal to the nation of their birth. If we need any further example of that, just read the public pronouncements of the executives of these multinational companies. Since we're talking about Ford, we notice that in the December 19, 1970 issue of Business Week magazine, Robert Stevenson, who was vice president of the Ford Motor Company, said this: "We don't consider ourselves basically an American company." Come as a surprise to you? That we don't consider ourselves basically an American company. We are a multinational company. And when we approach a government that doesn't like the United States, we always say, "Well, whom do you like? Britain? Germany? We carry a lot of flags." Along that same line, and perhaps even more to the point, we noticed that a top executive of the Mobil Oil Company in the fall of 1973 was on television, and this is what he said. He said, "I've never been faced with a situation where I'd say to myself, I'm only going to be a good citizen of one country. Because if I do that, I'm no longer a multinational oil company," end quote, which is certainly true. Another very instructive example of international cartels and all they represent and all they do is AT&T. We notice from the record that, like the Ford Motor Company, AT&T also invested heavily in pre-war Nazi Germany. Tremendous amounts of investment capital went to Germany and went directly into the corporate structures that were at that time busily engaged in preparations for war. In 1938, for instance, one of AT&T's subsidiaries in Germany acquired the ownership of 28% of the Focke-Wulf manufacturing facilities, the Focke-Wulf Corporation. As you may recall, this is the famous name that was attached to the German fighter planes, the Focke-Wulf fighter planes. This company was then in the production of these fighter planes, and AT&T acquired ownership of 28% ownership of the entire company. Other plants of AT&T in Germany, all during the war, were busily producing communications equipment for the Nazi high command. Meanwhile, back in the United States, AT&T was fiercely patriotic in defense of the American cause. In fact, the head of AT&T, who was Colonel Benn, received the Medal of Merit for all that he and his company had done, specifically in the invention and production of something called the Huff Duff. The Huff Duff, which was a new kind of sonar radar, which was able to detect Nazi submarines. And then finally, ladies and gentlemen, in 1967, this was 30 years after the fact of the war, 1967, AT&T received from the federal government, or I should say, received from you and me in the form of tax dollars taken from us in taxes, $27 million for damages inflicted on their Focke-Wulf plants in Germany during the war. The excuse for that was that this allegedly was American property damaged during the war. Well, okay, you see, it pays to have friends in Washington. These were the plants that were producing the German fighter planes. Anthony Sampson wrote a book called The Sovereign State of AT&T. And in that book, he had this very profound statement. He said, "Thus, while AT&T Focke-Wulf planes were bombing Allied ships and AT&T lines were passing information to German submarines, AT&T direction finders were saving other ships from their torpedoes. If the Nazis had won, AT&T in Germany would have appeared impeccably Nazi. As they lost, it reemerged as impeccably American." End quote. Let's turn our attention now to the question of the relationship between monopoly and government. It is a fact that monopoly cannot exist without government intervention. If monopoly does not have access to the levers of power of government to eliminate its competitors, then its competitors will compete, and it will no longer be a monopoly. We find that in history, all of the monopolies have had to rely on government to protect their monopolies. The robber barons of the past in this country are certainly a good example. If you recall the great dynasties that were carved out from the mountains and the prairies to build the transcontinental railroads across the United States, these dynasties were acquired through political influence, which literally gave millions upon millions of acres of land to the corporations over which to build their railroads. If they had to go out and buy that land or acquire it in some other way, they couldn't have done it. Certainly we know that the robber barons of the present cannot exist without the intervention of their political puppets. We have many examples of that. The so-called fair trade laws. That sounds very good. Fair trade laws. We certainly need fair trade, don't we? This is a law passed in the name of the people. And yet when you realize what a fair trade law is, it's a law which prevents the shopkeeper from cutting his prices to you, from lowering his prices. He is prohibited by law from offering you a product at a price lower than the one stamped on the box. Now, that is a perfect example of the use of government to protect the profit structure of a monopolistic industry. Another example are the new drug laws. A company today, in order to get a new drug on the market, has to go through tons and tons of paperwork and red tape. Now, that's all in the name of protecting the people, of course. After all, you don't want these new drugs coming on the market that are not thoroughly analyzed and checked and researched, do you? The end result of it is that the small drug company cannot afford to do that kind of paperwork, and so they are gradually being squeezed out by the large multinational drug companies that easily can afford the $1 or $2 to get the paperwork done. And so the large companies are using this law to squeeze out their small company competitors. The Federal Aeronautics and Aviation Board is another example. All the rules and regulations they have of preserving the routes among airlines. No small airline in the United States is able to get in there and try and compete because you need permission to fly from here to there. And you can't get permission. That's all nicely worked out between the major airlines so that there's no competition between them. And there's no competition on price either. That's all carefully worked out by the FAA. Those laws are there to prevent competition, ladies and gentlemen, not to protect you. What you pay for moving your furniture from one city to the next is fixed by law. There is no competition between moving companies on price. It's not allowed. Railway shipping charges are not allowed to be lowered below what the companies think they can charge. You cannot compete, even the delivery of milk to your door. The price of that milk is fixed at a level below which the supplier is not permitted to sell. It's all fixed by law. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this could go on and on. The economy of the United States, and surely of the world, in my opinion, is somewhere between 80 and 95% cartelized. We speak of a free enterprise system. You're dreaming. We have a certain semblance of it left. We have the outward appearances of it. The small entrepreneur is still in there plugging away, but he is being squeezed out by taxes, which the large businesses don't have to pay. The large cartelists, such as Rockefeller, have the tax-exempt foundations to preserve their great fortunes. They don't pay these taxes, but the little guy in there who's trying to compete is gradually being destroyed by laws which have been passed by the monopolists and the cartels to eliminate competition. The January 1973 issue of the Monthly Review of the Bank of Hawaii which is a pretty savvy bank. If you read their newsletters and their monthly reviews, they really know what's going on. It's a wonder they haven't been squeezed out, but they're still in there plugging away. The January 1973 monthly review of the Bank of Hawaii had this analysis. Quote, "There appears to be no ready answer to the complex, interrelated domestic and international developments. Those standing to lose the most include the individuals who seek to establish their own businesses and those independent domestic firms seeking to compete in the traditional open marketplace. They face increasing regimentation through bureaucratic red tape and preempted markets by federally subsidized competition. Virtually immune are the multinational corporations whose massive investments abroad and effective lobbying positions and allegiance to a world market unobstructed by local government and competition place them in a position to not only straddle these developments but to encourage them." End quote. Several years ago, a book was published by Ferdinand Lundberg called The Rich and the Super Rich. There's a lot in that book that makes me quite angry. I think it's a little too many of the old leftist cliches about exploitation of the working class and so forth. But there's a lot in that book to benefit from, a lot of knowledge and a lot of truth. Lundberg put aside his cliches long enough at one point to make, I think, a profound observation. He said, "The restriction of free enterprise has also come principally from businessmen who have constantly sought to increase government regulation in their own interest, as in the case of tariffs, subsidies, and prohibition of price cutting on trademarked items. In fact, the interests of businessmen have changed to a considerable extent from efficiency in production to efficiency in public manipulation, including manipulation of the government for attainment of preferential advantages." End quote. Now that, ladies and gentlemen, in a nutshell, is what the ball game is all about. The biggest industries today, the multinationals, are not interested so much in efficiency in production or competition at price or product level, but they are competing at the government level. They are competing with each other to capture control of the levers of government so they can then use the power structure of government to eliminate or hinder their competition. Now, that is why we have the paradox of the rich socialist. This is one of the things that the new student of the subject can never quite understand, why rich men, the richest men in the nation, as a matter of fact, are apparently socialists and promoting the welfare state and other collectivist schemes. The answer is they need government. Monopoly needs government to enforce its monopoly and to oppose its competition. And they need a socialist government. They need a collectivist government. They are sure that because of their tremendous political influence in that government, that they themselves can escape the negative features of that government control. They are sure that because of their wealth, they can buy enough politicians and bureaucrats so that the rules and regulations that suppress the average man will somehow not apply to them. And generally, they have been right. In other words, they are planning to rule. And they are planning to rule you and me. Let's turn now to the question of world government. It is another fact that the United Nations was created and sustained by two apparently opposed groups. The super-rich industrialists, principally centered around that organization called the Council on Foreign Relations, and another group centered around the International Communist Party. Now, back in 1964, when I published my first book called The Fearful Master, A Second Look at the United Nations, the level of my awareness of what was going on in the world was, frankly, quite limited. At that time, about all I could see was the menace of international communism. And in the book, I concentrated almost entirely on the extent to which identified communists, primarily those working on the federal payroll at the time, although they were not identified at the time, later they were identified. They were secret communists working primarily in the State Department and the Treasury Department. These men and women were responsible primarily for the work done in creating the United Nations. If I were to rewrite that book today, I don't think I would change a single part of it except that part. Everything else stands just as accurately today as it was in 1964. But upon further research, further awakening to the facts of life around me, I discovered that there were a lot of people involved other than communists, but people who shared exactly the same objectives and goals as those of the Communist Party, but people who were certainly not communists, they were very wealthy, wealthy men. And then I had to go through this awakening and this question asking and answering to find out why and how could people like this become involved with communists. The truth of the matter is that I believe when you go through the list, you will find that there are 74, and there may be more, but I have been able to find 74 prominent people in the creation of the United Nations in this country who were members of the CFR. 74. Now, many of those were also communists. They were members of the CFR and members of the Communist Party, but most of them were merely members of the CFR, as far as we know. Now, why should members of the CFR, which represents the international monopoly in this country, the CFR primarily is a grouping of very wealthy industrialists from the highest multinational corporations, why should they become involved in the UN? And the reason, I may be sounding a little redundant here because I'm repeating myself, is that monopolists and cartels need world government in order to elevate their monopoly to the world level. They are sure that they can and do control this world government. The fact that the cartel has fostered the United Nations and continues to support it in every way possible is obvious to even the most casual observer. We note, for instance, that the very land on which the United Nations stands was donated by Rockefeller. We note, for instance, that the Chase Manhattan Bank, which is a Rockefeller bank, is the United Nations official banker. We notice, for instance, that the president of the UN World Bank for many years was John J. McCloy, who was chairman of the board of directors of the Chase Manhattan Bank. We notice, for instance, that David Rockefeller is chairman of the CFR, which is the organization that supplies so much of the encouragement and staffing of the United Nations and the State Department, which also has supported the United Nations for so many years. There's an interesting person by the name of Charles Levinson, who is secretary of the International Federation of Chemical and General Workers Union in Geneva, Switzerland. Now, he's had a long life of battling the multinational cartels. He knows what they're all about from firsthand experience. He has been a negotiator with many of their leaders. In the June 17, 1974 issue of the Wall Street Journal, there was an article based on an interview with Charles Levinson, and this is what that article said. Instead of seeking truth, Mr. Levinson says the UN officials want clowns to perform in a forum carefully contrived to make the UN look alive while giving the multinationals a protective coat of whitewash. In Mr. Levinson's view, the UN and such prestigious private groups as the Washington-based Atlantic Council and the Rockefeller Foundation are all part of an international elite that manages much of the world's business, finance, politics, and even wars to its own advantage. To a large extent, he says, the power is centered within David Rockefeller's operation. End quote. Please note, ladies and gentlemen, that he is a socialist. I'll have a few comments on that in closing, but I'm going to give you an advance peek at some interesting things that are happening around the world. People are coming together from large, diverse points of view, many diverse points of view. They're coming together, closer together. and that is a healthy sign. Yes, it's true that the American people know a lot of things that simply are not true. For instance, we know that there is a deep and impassable gulf that exists between the anti-establishment radicals and the moss-backed conservative constitutionalists. No way can these people ever come together. And that is not so. The anti-establishment radicals are right when they condemn monopoly capitalism. They're absolutely 100% correct. And many of the conservatives have not been able to recognize that truth when they heard it. But these anti-establishment radicals must also realize that the monopoly capitalists whom they condemn are not the torchbearers of the traditional American way of life. They do not represent free enterprise capitalism. They must realize that these monopoly capitalists are, in fact, the very leaders of the ideology which the anti-establishment radicals are promoting, that of socialism, collectivism. And so, therefore, they must realize that they have been tricked into doing the very work of the people whom they despise. On the other hand, the moss-backed, reactionary, conservative constitutionalists are right when they condemn and point with alarm to subversion in our government and the growth of that government itself and the resulting loss of individual liberty. But they must stop falling for the same old shell game, too, and being tricked into promoting the objectives of the very people they despise. They have simply got to stop running to the polls every 2 years and every 4 years and electing members of the CFR or others involved in large cartel industry or the foundations who are part of the very establishment which they are opposing. And so, in truth, what I'm trying to say here to you this morning, ladies and gentlemen, is that there are practically no real differences between any group in the vast majority of the American people, regardless of all of the superficial things that divide us, regardless of the length of our hair, our sex, our race, our age, our religion, our education, our lifestyles, regardless of all of those things, we are all Americans. And the time to close ranks against our common enemy is now.
Intriguingly, that's where the audio ends. I say intriguingly because I'm still not 100% clear on who the common enemy is. I suppose he talked about we are all Americans. The common enemy may be non-Americans. If he'd said we are all citizens of Earth and we must come together, certainly I would have given that my full backing. As it is, a rather quizzical note on which to end. I think, for what it's worth, that the ongoing process of globalization, the fact that differences of language, race, national origin seem to mean very little when you post a video to YouTube or when you download one, and I don't see why they should, I think that process is quickly rendering old ideas about patriotism, about love of one's country, obsolete as quickly as the process of disenfranchisement, the process of people being disillusioned with just what kind of leaders their nations have and what kind of histories many of them have. But if the moral, cultural, and often legal structure of the nation state is being eroded, what's going to replace it? Is it going to be an unelected, unaccountable plutarchy, a faceless autocratic system of surveillance and control? Well, that appears to be the way many countries are going, and yet events such as Tahrir Square show the people are not happy and want to change how things are done. Arguably, you could look at the London riots and say that too was an expression of powerlessness, an expression of anger. On this note, I should mention Occupy Wall Street, which, if you've been watching too much corporate media, you may not have heard of. Worth Googling on that phrase, Occupy Wall Street, and follow a trail to thousands of people who are occupying the financial district of New York in protest about the influence of money over politics. Now, do these people have clear alternatives and agendas they want to put forward? I have to say, probably not very well worked out. But I think their central point, that 1% of America owns a third of the wealth, and that this should not be so, is pretty unanswerable. Certainly has global ramifications. Situation may not be as extreme in every country, but that's certainly a general tendency worldwide. 1% of the population pretty much has control of the financial, the legal, the political, and the other centralized hierarchies, because they've made it their business to have control. They have monopoly, more or less, on the institutions which claim to represent all of the people, which claim to be working for society's benefit. And what are they doing with all this power? Well, recall Milton Friedman's candid admission at the start of the show. Do you know anywhere else that doesn't run on greed? Of course, everybody's self-interested, equating that with the kind of psychopathic greed that knows no bounds and feels no compassion. In the 11 years this show has been running, we've covered manifold abuses of the various power systems, and I wouldn't be bothering to continue this show if I didn't think that at some point push will come to shove and people will say, look, enough is enough. How about we the people decide better ways of doing things? And this will be a mixture of technologies which circumvent the existing practices, a mixture of refusal to go along with unjust systems, but people need courage to take that kind of a stand. If the internet is any guide, which may not be taken for granted, I've been encouraged to see the Occupy Wall Street movement spreading to dozens of cities across the US and others worldwide. Seems to me there's many threads, but all of this is about injustice, the inequality, and the fact that they're occupying Wall Street is indicative of the fact that people have understood that big money is ripping them off. And what is not normally noted is that money itself is a business, that it's a privately controlled monopoly. In the US, the dollar is controlled by the Federal Reserve Corporation, which, despite pretenses to be public and a kind of a pseudo connection to government, is basically a private business. And that, as we shall hear, was founded after a lot of wrangling. It's not the first privately owned central bank in the world, and it's something that only in very recent years has come to people's attention, that money itself is a business. So if you rent land, you expect to pay regularly to the landlord, and if you use money, you will be paying, or someone else will be paying, to those who created the money, to the central banks. Now, we've got more details on that in the excellent series on money creation and a lot of the tricky political issues around money by the anonymous financial insider, Smithy, whom I have so far failed to contact. But if you're listening to this show, I salute you. It was my introduction to the crooked world of finance. And all the shows are available. You can Google on Wizards of Money and find your way to 22 audio episodes with transcripts, or you can look them up from this show's webpage. And we're now going to hear an interview with another woman who is an expert on the history of money, and she will explain some of the finer points. This is an interview by Ken McDermott Rowe of Ellen Brown. And his show is History Counts. For more such interviews. And this was carried out in 2010.
Who creates money? Who does the current money system benefit? And who does it hurt? To help us understand this important subject, we're very fortunate to have as our guest today author and attorney Ellen Hodgson Brown. An experienced Los Angeles litigator, Ms. Brown has written extensively on subjects ranging from finance to health care. She's the author of 11 books, as well as numerous articles which have appeared in the Huffington Post and publications of the Center for Research on Globalization. Today we're going to talk about her book, Web of Debt, in which she analyzes the history, operations, and effects of the money system. Ellen, thanks very much for joining us today on History Counts.
Thanks, Ken.
Why should the average person care about the type of money system we have, and how does it affect him or her?
It's actually because we don't understand our money system that we've been caught in this debt trap. For example, there's a big push to balance the budget. Everybody's worried about the federal debt, and President Obama appointed a commission looking into how to fix the deficit. Well, what they're looking at is yet more austerity measures at a time when people are already suffering. They don't have jobs, and they're dependent on Social Security, and they're talking about cutting back on Social Security because there's this thought that debt is a bad thing. What people need to understand is that all of our money is debt. There is nothing in our monetary system except debt. Private debt has collapsed. When the housing market collapsed, private debt collapsed. So public debt or government debt has to replace it, or we don't have any money in our money supply. We don't have anything to run our businesses, nothing to buy goods with.
So ultimately, the way you earn a living, how much you make, the level of your own debt, interest rates, all of these things play into the type of money system we have?
Right.
Well, could you please take us back in time and talk about the role of goldsmiths in creating the modern money system?
Well, the goldsmiths couldn't come into England until the 17th century. Then they were admitted into England, and they were allowed to lend gold. And in 1666, there was a Free Coinage Act, which allowed them to actually turn gold into coins. Before that, it was a sovereign right of the king or queen to create the national money supply, and nobody else could do it.
Now, the goldsmith would receive gold from depositors, but then he figured out a way to actually lend money on the gold, and in some cases, lend more money than he actually had in gold. How did he do that?
The goldsmith kept people's gold for safekeeping, but nobody really wanted to carry this gold around. It was unsafe, and it was heavy. So instead, the goldsmith would issue these little paper receipts that eventually became called banknotes. And people actually preferred to trade the paper receipts over trading the gold. So the goldsmiths discovered that people only came for their gold about 10% of the time. And some people wanted to borrow the gold, but they too only wanted the paper receipts. So the goldsmiths discovered that they could issue 10 times as many paper receipts as they had gold. And then they charged interest on that. If they charged 10% interest on 10 pieces of paper, all representing the same gold, they were making 100% interest on the deal. So it was a very good deal for the goldsmiths. And that was the basis of our fractional reserve system that we have today.
Which essentially is making money out of thin air and then lending it to people.
Well, that's another thing that nobody understands. Banks do not lend other people's money. Everybody thinks that banks lend their depositors money. That's not true. Every time a bank makes a loan, it creates brand new money. Now, it's not actually fraudulent because the banks are on the hook for that. What they're basically doing is extending you credit and charging you interest because maybe you won't pay it back. So they are taking some risk and they're performing a service. But what needs to be known is what's actually happening here. Because a much better system, and this is what I recommend, would be public banking, where the interest would go back to the community. Because it's really the community's credit that's being lent here. It's not anything owned by the banker.
Well, where does the money come from to pay the interest on the debt that's owed to the goldsmith or the banker?
That money, too, has to be created out of thin air because there is no other source of money in the system except for coins, which today in the U.S. compose 1/10,000th of the money supply. they're mere tokens. They're really there to make us think that the government's creating the money, but they really are insignificant. So all of the money really is created when people take out loans from banks. And since they create the principal, but they don't create the interest, somebody somewhere has to be taking out another loan to cover the interest on the original loans that are our money supply.
Well, can you talk about the king or the sovereign's historical power to create money and how this came to be changed in England in the late 1600s?
It had been considered the sovereign right of the king to create money. Many people think that gold is the original money system and that it just evolved, that people were trading in gold because that was convenient. But even the gold coins or whatever kind of coins, of course, the first coins weren't even gold. They were made out of bronze, but they were stamped with the face of the king or queen, the sovereign, and that is what gave them their value. They were not really as valuable as the number stamped on them, and they couldn't be. If you stamped a gold piece that was worth, let's say today in dollars, let's say it was worth $100. If you stamped it with $100, then when the price of gold would go up, people would melt the coins down and trade the gold instead. So if you want to keep your coins around, you have to make them less valuable in their metal than the number stamped on them. So it was actually the sovereign who gave them their value. So then what happened in the 17th century was that this became privatized, because now the goldsmiths, who were private individuals, started trading in coins, and they then started this ruse where they were issuing paper money supposedly backed by coins, but it wasn't. And then in 1694, when the king needed money, he borrowed from this group of bankers. They weren't even British, actually.
These are the Dutch bankers, and these are the people who are brought in after James II is thrown out as king of England in the 1688 revolution. These Dutch bankers come in with William of Orange, the Dutchman.
Technically, the king shouldn't have had to borrow from anyone. He should have been able to issue the money he needed. But, like you say, William of Orange was one of them.
Was that the rebels who overthrew the Stuarts, James II, and resisted Charles II, his predecessor? Was part of their modus operandi to make an alliance with these foreign bankers in hopes that they could finance their revolution and then make a deal with the foreign bankers to privatize the money system? Was there sort of a quid pro quo there?
There's certainly the implication. That's what it was all about, that it was actually the Dutch bankers who sponsored that whole revolution.
So now they come in with the Dutch, William of Orange, who becomes the new King of England. Do they then create the Bank of England? Is that how it comes into being?
Right. 1694 was the founding of the Bank of England, and it was given the right and power to issue their own banknotes, Bank of England banknotes, and lent them to the government, and these became the national money supply. And, of course, the ruse was supposedly these were backed by gold, but the bank would issue about six times as many notes as they had gold. It was the same thing where they were really creating this paper money and charging interest on it to the government.
You quote from a Bank of England circular in your book to potential investors in the Bank of England. It says, quote, "The bank hath the benefit of interest on all monies which it creates out of nothing." It's a nice business if you can get it.
Correct.
There was then the money system of England becomes based upon an ever-growing national debt, and this national debt has to be paid back in interest, which is generated from the taxpayers of England, right?
And then meanwhile, in the colonies, they didn't have precious metals, and so they developed this alternative system, which is the ideal system. I think it's our own American system, was a publicly issued money system.
How did the Pennsylvanians raise money before America became independent?
All of the colonies just issued their own money. This went back to, it was 1691, so it's actually predated the Bank of England when the governor of Massachusetts needed money to fight a little war, and he couldn't find anybody to borrow from, so he got the bright idea if he would just issue these little paper receipts to his soldiers and merchants and people that he would owed money to. And then those receipts traded in the community, and they became the local money supply. So the problem with that system is that there were 13 colonies eventually, and some of them just printed and printed, and that did become inflationary. But the best of the systems was in Pennsylvania, and that was Benjamin Franklin's colony, and he wrote all about it. And it was called the father of paper money because he thought it was such a great idea, and it was he who promoted it, although he didn't invent it, but he promoted it. Their system was that this colony actually owned a bank. It not only printed money and spent it, but the government printed money and lent it. So most of this money was lent to the farmers. So they would print up this paper scrip, lend it to the farmers, charge them 5% interest, which was a better deal than they could get before. Plus, even at the higher interest rate, they just couldn't get it. The gold just wasn't there in the colony, so nobody wanted to come there because there was no money. So suddenly they had a money supply. It was cheaper than their previous money. And then to cover that 5% interest, the government would spend some extra. So they would print and spend some, but most of it was printed and lent. So then you had enough money out there in the money supply to pay principal and interest, and all the money came back to the government. And then they could recycle that same money over and over. So it wasn't inflationary.
The money was actually backed not by a precious metal, but then by a future government revenue.
Right. It was based on the labor of the community, basically. Yeah. You were paying for services delivered to the community, or you were lending it.
Franklin stressed that it was this money system which made Pennsylvania so prosperous in the 18th century, but he seemed to recognize that one of the key ingredients was that new money be issued in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry. Is this a critical consideration in avoiding inflation?
It is, and of course there were other colonies that were issuing too much, and that was what got the colonies in trouble overall. In 1750s, King George said they couldn't come out with new issues of paper money. But actually, Pennsylvania was the most sound of the systems, and so they were allowed to continue until Franklin went to London to petition Parliament to lift the ban. And they realized that they had lost the cash cow here, and so it was totally opposed to the whole Bank of England system, and they were totally opposed to it. So what happened was King George II said they couldn't do it at all. So there was a ban on issuing money for all the colonies, which caused an instant depression. People just didn't have the money anymore to run their businesses. And so it was the same situation we have today where people got laid off and then they didn't have the money to buy goods and then there was no market for goods.
So there's a double whammy. You don't have enough money, and if you somehow get the money, you have to pay interest on it.
Right. The worst part was they had to pay taxes in the gold or in the British money system, which was supposedly backed by gold, but of course most of it wasn't. So here they were paying in essentially a foreign currency, even though they were British colonies, but you know, it was money that was going overseas in a currency they didn't have and didn't have access to.
Was this money situation a significant factor in why the colonies revolted against Britain?
It was, according to a number of historians, that really was what the revolution was all about. It wasn't so much that they had to pay a tax. The problem was that they had to pay a tax in a currency not their own. They had to borrow this currency, which put them in debt to foreign lenders, foreign masters.
Now, the establishment of the United States as an independent country did not resolve forever the question of what type of money system we would have. And from the founding of the American public in 1789 to the 20th century, there was a great debate over whether the United States should create a private central bank like the Bank of England. Could you talk about the views of Alexander Hamilton, who was the first Secretary of the Treasury, who established the first Bank of the United States?
He resorted to the Bank of England system, but he really had no choice because the British hyperinflated the money supply. They were madly printing this paper currency during the Revolutionary War, but nobody realized that was what had gone wrong. And Continental, the paper scrip, totally collapsed. So there was counterfeiting by the British. That was one problem. Plus, people just didn't respect the currency because, you know, they weren't sure this army was going to win and that they would rather have gold, of course, given the choice. So by the end of the war, this paper Continental had collapsed in value. So Congress was afraid to put that in the Constitution, that Congress could issue their own money. They should have, but they didn't because they didn't understand what had gone wrong with this paper money. So there was Hamilton stuck with these war debts. and no money to pay them with. So even if they had issued a paper currency, people wouldn't have trusted it because they'd had this bad experience with the Continental. So they resorted to the ruse. Hamilton set up the first U.S. bank, which was 80% privately owned and eventually 100% privately owned. And they put the gold of the government, what little there was, in this bank, and then they leveraged it like a bank does. So they lent out 10 times as many paper notes as they had gold. But everybody thought the currency was now sound because they could take their paper money and cash it in for gold. So it worked, but the problem was that it initiated this system where it's a fraudulent system where we're in debt to private bankers who are pretending to be lending us money. And in fact, that's what Jefferson said when he figured this out. Well, he finally realized that these were, he called them bankrupt and bold adventurers just pretending to have money. So these bankers were pretending to be lending us money that they didn't really have, and here we were paying them interest on it. So he figured out the ruse, and he said that the state should give Congress the power to issue the national money supply, but it didn't happen.
He was also concerned about foreign control. You mentioned that in 1811, about three-quarters of the shares of the First Bank of the United States were owned by foreigners, mainly British people and Dutch.
Right, and nobody really knew who owned the bank until the charter wasn't renewed, and then they got to have a look, and they saw that indeed there were foreigners. And that was also Jackson's concern, that they were giving the power over. It was basically the British bankers, who weren't even British, you know, originally they came from Holland, who were going to be in charge of our money supply. They had recaptured the country by debt, which they had lost. They lost it politically, but they recaptured it economically.
So that's a very significant way a foreign power can project itself into another country's affairs through banking.
Which they've done today, of course, obviously.
The bank that was created by Hamilton had a certain duration. It expired. It wasn't renewed. And then again, there was a second Bank of the United States, and that was the one that President Andrew Jackson killed.
Right. There was actually a depression after Jackson.
I think you suggest in your book that the head of the Second Bank of the United States may have caused the depression in order to intimidate President Jackson.
He threatened to, and that was exposed.
So the money system then was sort of in a limbo. During the Civil War, you write that this again became a very important question. Could you talk about President Abraham Lincoln and his issuance of greenbacks?
As soon as he got elected, there he was with this war in his hands, which there was evidence that it was actually precipitated by the British bankers, and they were attempting to make loans to him at 24 to 36% interest, like highly usurious loans. And Lincoln could see this would bankrupt the country, and so he refused to do it. He issued the money directly. He went back to the system of the American colonists, where he issued paper money called greenbacks that were U.S. notes, direct issuance, and that worked really well. It wasn't the only thing that funded the war, but he managed to win the war, and he escaped this huge debt that there was this effort to impose on the North.
Of course, these would be interest-free because he wouldn't be going to a private bank to get the notes. He'd just print them. And
right. They weren't even debt-based. They were money.
They were real money. Without interest that he would use, I assume, to pay soldiers and suppliers for government's needs. And then those greenbacks, once they got into circulation, would become part of the money system.
Right.
Unfortunately, President Lincoln's assassinated, and the greenback comes to an end. Why was that?
Well, it was the same bankers that wanted control of the system again. From the Civil War to 1900, there was always a third political party that was trying to get the greenbacks reinstituted or to get the money supply expanded again.
So the issue of debt-based money versus government-issued money was a really hot issue in the late 19th century. And then in November of 1910, there was a very important secret meeting held, which related to this issue, at Jekyll Island in Georgia. Could you talk about the interests that were represented in that 1910 Jekyll Island meeting and what came out of the meeting?
Rockefeller and Morgan were the two big bankers. There was evidence presented in hearings that Morgan was funded by the Rothschild bankers. So he was actually the one with the link to the British bankers. There's also evidence that Morgan precipitated a run on the banks, a really bad bank panic in 1907. Because of that, the populace was persuaded that we needed a backup bank, a banker's bank that could provide the money when there was a run on the banks. They were run on the banks because the whole thing was a fraud. But instead of saying, all right, we're going to start all over and skip the fraud and make an honest system here, they backed up the fraud with yet one more fraud, which would be a central bank that would have the power to actually issue money. But the catch was that it would be issuing money, lending it to the government, and charging interest on it. Finally, the Rothschilds basically had gotten the Bank of England private central banking model established in the U.S. I mean, they'd been fighting for that for 200 years, and they finally got it in.
So that's what comes out of the Jekyll Island meeting of 1910, is the 1913 Federal Reserve Act.
Right.
So essentially, it works on the Bank of England model. The federal government needs money. It goes to the Federal Reserve instead of issuing its own money and says, we need money. The Federal Reserve has the cash printed up at the Bureau of Engraving, and the federal government in return gives the Federal Reserve government securities, indebtedness, which has to be paid back by the United States taxpayers. And these securities, do they become the reserves of the central bank?
Yes. So it's a shell game. They print up these little pink pieces of paper, and the other party prints up these little green pieces of paper, and they swap them and pretend like something's happened here. We should have issued the green pieces of paper directly.
That would be the Pennsylvania model.
Right.
Who owns the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, for example?
It's owned by about 500 banks, all the banks in the District of New York. The two big banks are the Morgan Bank and the Rockefeller Bank.
Does the Federal Reserve, because of its control over the creation of money, have a significant influence over the expansion or contraction of the economy?
They don't have the control they think they do. They provide the reserves so that the banks can make loans, but they can't force the banks to make loans. No matter how much they put out there in the way of reserves, if the banks don't feel like using it for making loans they want.
I think you relate the lead up to the crash of 29, and it had to do with the New York Fed, Benjamin Strong, cooperating with Montague Norman of the Bank of England, and that there was an easy money policy on the part of the Federal Reserve in order to accommodate British interest in defending the pound, and that contributed to the crash of 29 and the subsequent depression.
Yes, we basically gave away our gold so that the British could maintain the pound at the exchange rate that it was, and that just didn't work, and in the end the whole thing collapsed. They have essentially succeeded in imposing a private central bank almost in every single country that is controlled by this whole international banking cartel.
Do these cartels tend to have a high degree of influence over elected officials?
Totally. I mean, you can see that in Congress. Congress is sort of deadlocked because the bankers have just own the place.
Do these bankers get access to inside information about monetary matters before the rest of us?
The Treasury has been called Goldman Sachs South. You come up with pretty good evidence that Goldman Sachs actually manipulates the market. So it manipulates the dollar up when that's politically desired. And they do that by meeting with all the other central bankers behind closed doors, and they all agree to buy dollars, and that props the dollar up. And you can see that in times when it absolutely the dollar should have collapsed, it doesn't collapse, it stays up, or something brings the financial sector back up when it should have collapsed. Something suppresses gold when it should have been going up. There's no such thing as a free market anymore. It's all controlled. And there's a clear revolving door between Goldman Sachs and the Treasury.
Let's imagine that the money system in the United States were changed and that the federal government ran it along the lines of the Pennsylvania model that Benjamin Franklin espoused. What would happen, for example, to the trillions of dollars of outstanding national debt?
As the bonds came due, they would just be paid off with the dollars. And it actually would be fine. Everybody thinks this would be inflationary, but it wouldn't. What happens right now is they always do pay off the bonds, but then they roll them over. So, in other words, they do a new bond issue and get more people to buy bonds. So if you own bonds and your bonds come due, and you usually it's through Treasury Direct, which is all computerized, so you just look at your account there at Treasury Direct, and you get this little notice that says your bond just came due, and you now have, whatever, $10,000 in your account. I mean, it's just all numbers on a screen. So none of that would change. But now if you went to take that $10,000 and to roll it over into new bond, the Treasury Direct would say, sorry, we're not selling bonds anymore. and then they would just issue the money they needed directly after that.
So then essentially the government securities that are outstanding would gradually be replaced with interest-free money, like sort
right.
of like the greenbacks, which would just be issued debt-free by the government. So over time, the entire national debt could be transformed into debt-free money, and it would, the money supply wouldn't necessarily be affected.
Right, because the debt itself trades as money. Those bonds trade around the world just as if they're money, and they trade every day. If you own a $10,000 bond, you think you've got $10,000 in your account. You're not going to be any richer if it looks like $10,000 in dollars instead of a $10,000 bond. You're not going to rush out and start buying stuff and flooding the economy with money.
How much of our income taxes goes to paying interest on the national debt? Is it significant?
It's about a third of the income tax bill right now. 2006, the federal debt was $8 trillion. It's now $12 trillion. It's gone up by 50%, and yet we're paying the same interest. And the reason is that they've dropped interest rates very, very low.
So if interest rates were to return to historically more normal rates, say 4 or 5%.
We'd be wiped out, yeah.
We would be wiped out because the interest service on the national debt would probably absorb.
It would take the whole income tax bill, yeah.
In what ways would the average citizen be affected by a change to a debt-free money system?
They could build infrastructure on credit. It's the credit of the country. So let's say you wanted to build a high-speed train between Los Angeles and San Francisco. You would pay for the thing on credit, credit drawn from your own central bank or your own state bank. So you pay for your workers, you pay your materials, and then you owe a debt back to your own bank. And as you collect fees, once the train is built and you start collecting revenues, then the revenues go back to pay off the loan. So you've increased the goods and services in the system, and you've increased the money in the system, so you haven't created inflation. So you could do all these things that we desperately need. We've got the workers. We've got the materials. We've got the brains. The only thing we're lacking is the medium of exchange. So create the medium of exchange, and we can have it. We can have it all.
Ellen, thanks very much for being with us today. You're listening to History Counts. This is your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I've been speaking about the money system with Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt. Ellen's
thanks.
Websites, you're very welcome. Thank you for being with us. Ellen's websites are ellenbrown.com and webofdebt.com. And is there another website you wanted to mention, Ellen?
Well, we have a new one, publicbanking.com. It's public-banking.com.
Thank you very much, Ellen.
Thank you, Ken.
My shiny black bits.
Now, I'm considering making a show on the Occupy Wall Street movement, perhaps with something about the Arab Spring connection. So if you're involved in any direct action occupation strategy, especially if you have any recordings of what was said there in English, then I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at unwelcome@unwelcomeguests.net. And if you'd like to download this show or any of the previous shows, they're available
from our MP3 archive, which is unwelcomeguests.net/archive. There's also a mailing list for any discussion of the show at altruists.org/unwelcome. And we have a Twitter feed announcing new episodes at twitter.com/unwelcomeguests. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.
Will always be filled by